Our passage today is in chapter 11. We're nearing the end of our study here. Some of you are probably a little bit relieved at that. It's been kind of a dark journey through this, and yet what important reminders of the bankruptcy of man's wisdom. That in the end, it doesn't give us a story big enough for our hearts. It doesn't give us happiness that lasts. Then in a world where we find ourselves longing for purpose and meaning, that worldly wisdom comes up short. You know, you get the sense that this man is doing his best to impart reality the way things are. He's trying to impart some wisdom. Those naive dreams of that child, they're not going to come true. And so better to get disappointed now and get over it and face the realities of life. And I think this is much of what is coming across in our text. And yet, as we read it, we see the despair and the woundedness and the hurt. We're challenged by the remaining books in Scripture to see through the bankruptcy of this and to realize that what we are being called to is to walk in light of something different. Jesus would say to walk in light of eternity. And in Hebrews, it describes these people that walk by faith as those that have walked in a manner that the world is not worthy of. And I think that the signs of those people is a peacefulness, a joy that can't be burst. There's a resilience and a strength to them. They're a sign of what all of us are being called to have that inner joy, that inner peace, that inner security that is unfazed by what life throws at it. Solomon tells us in the end of chapter 10, verses 16 through 20, he says, "Woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility, whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness. Through indolence the rafters sag, and through slackness the house leaks. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes the life merry, and money is the answer to everything. Furthermore, in your bedchamber do not curse a king, and in your sleeping rooms do not curse a rich man, for a bird of the heavens will carry the sound, and the winged creatures will make the matter known." And as Solomon is describing this, he's saying, and this is going to be the conclusion that he reaches, that there is good in life. There's the immediate pleasures, immediate gratification, and so enjoy those things. That's the best that life has to offer us. But you know what? At the same time, if you can delay gratification, that's wisdom. Delay gratification. And in the end, you may have more good times than bad times. And what you see with that, do you see the wisdom? There's wisdom in it. And yet there's this sort of resignation. And he's going to, in our text today, once again at the end of all this, say, even though it's all meaningless. And we've learned this by now, that Solomon's wisdom is the wisdom of the world. It's better than the foolishness of the world, which is indulging itself in the morning, feasting in the morning, and having nothing left for tomorrow. And he's going to say, prepare for the dark times, but realize that they're inevitable. And I think about this, you know, this mindset, it may be like couched in all this good intention, and yet what comes with it is a hopelessness, a joylessness. I was reading this in a book called Walking on Water. The author, Madeleine L'Engle, was saying that 90% of children think creatively. You put paper and crayons in front of them and they just go. She says this dwindles, it dwindles so rapidly towards the later years of life, 2% of people have that sort of inspiration to life, that creativity, that joyfulness that comes in that. And I think it's because as we find ourselves resigning to life, we basically start living life based on our resources and really, in the end, our strengths. We avoid the areas that we're weak because that draws criticism. And we lean towards the areas that are going to bring us praise. And so we start asking ourselves this question, not what am I interested in painting, but am I a painter? Am I good enough? Is somebody going to point a finger at me and say I'm bad? And if we are good enough, that starts becoming our identity. And see how we fall in such a young age into really a self-obsession and a self-entrapment. It's almost like our natural survival instinct. Underneath all of this, and I think this is a fundamental mistake that we have in the book of Ecclesiastes, is the assumption that, number one, this life is all we have, and number two, that this life is supposed to be lived for its enjoyment. Now, that doesn't mean that we're supposed to avoid enjoyment. Of course not. But this idea that this life, the purpose of this life, is for our contentment and satisfaction is a misunderstanding. I love how Benjamin Franklin said, he said, those things that hurt instruct. And I think this is really a truth, that really life and the events of life are all a part of us on a journey, on a story, and it's one in which we are having the opportunity to grow. And the outward things that we go through are mere reflections of what God is doing far more significantly inside, in our hearts. But in order for us to counteract this gravitational pull of cynicism, it requires us to learn how to think different. Think differently. Think different is programmed in from the Apple sales pitch. We have to, in many ways, unlearn. And I think this is why Jesus points to the child and says, that smiling little girl up there, you need to think about that. That joy. That's how life is meant to be lived. Thomas Traherne says, without much ado, I was corrupted and made to learn the dirty devices of this world, which now I unlearn and become as it were a little child again, that I might enter into the kingdom of God. How do we have that trust? See, it's not to fall back into the foolishness of the world's fool, but it's to transcend the worldly wisdom to become a child of God. Ecclesiastes 11, 1 through 8 is our passage for today. I want to read it for you guys, and then we're going to go through verse by verse and kind of pick out the wisdom. And again, mind you, the wisdom in here is not wrong. In fact, it can be helpful. But where it goes wrong is in its scope when it limits itself to the length of our days here on earth. Verse 1 says, cast your bread on the surface of the waters, for you will find it after many days. Divide your portion to seven or even to eight, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. If the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth. And whether a tree falls toward the south or toward the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. He who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. Just as you do not know the path of the wind and how bones are formed in the womb of the pregnant woman, so you do not know the activity of God who makes all things. Sow your seed in the morning and do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed, or whether both of them alike will be good. The light is pleasant, and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything that is to come will be futility. Again, you hear the resignation, right? But he doesn't have bad advice in the sense that in verse 1 he says, cast your bread on the waters. And this may mean he's simply saying invest your money overseas. Whatever he's saying is take what you have today and invest it for the future. Get a return. But then in verse 2, I think he continues the same thought by saying, but don't put all your eggs in one basket. Split it up 7 ways, 8 ways, so that you don't lose it all in one shot, because everything that we do in this life is risky. So the only thing that's predictable is unpredictability. In verse 3, he says, if the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth. And he's saying, there's certain things in life that are inevitable. There's nothing you could do about it. It's not like looking at them can stop the rain from falling. And whether a tree falls toward the south or toward the north, which he's saying, who knows which way the tree is going to fall, but when it falls, there it lies. And again, you see him saying, life is not only filled with these kind of inevitable things, but predicting those things is oftentimes futile. So that if we live our life based on a pursuit of certainty, knowing all the ends, we'll never begin. Verse 4, he says, he who watches the wind will not sow, he who looks at the clouds will not reap. So in our puzzling over the risks in life, we can become immobilized and not act and not sow, but we need to for our very survival. Sorry, my allergies are kicking in. In verse 5, there's a great moment of reflection, though, where he's saying, because in the end, the unknowability is caught up in the fact that what's going on is so much bigger than us. He uses the example of a pregnant woman and the forming of the bones of a baby. This is a great image. I think nothing feels as helpless than being a dad-to-be. There's just absolutely nothing in your control. So little of what you did actually got this thing started. And here's this baby that's formed and you've had no hands on anything. And all the things that could go wrong are all out of your control. And you find yourself just hoping and praying because there's nothing we can do to affect the outcome of that but trust. And so much of life, I think he's rightly saying, is like that. It's mysterious. If we don't see the mystery, it's just that we've become used to it. But we can get so caught up in trying to figure things out that we get immobilized. And I think there's a good little bit for us to ponder there. Because if you're like me, which some of you are, we fall into this idea of trying to calculate our way through life. Anybody else do this? Kind of live life based on, okay, what's the worst thing that can happen here, and am I ready for it? Do I have insurance to cover that? Maybe you've been burned in the past, and you're thinking, okay, that's not happening again, so how do I couch my life waiting for these dark things to happen? And he's saying, look, you'll just drive yourself mad, and I think he's right. I love this by Chesterton. He was saying, it's not imagination that breeds insanity. Exactly what does breed insanity is reason. Poets do not go mad, but chess players do. Mathematicians go mad and cashiers, but creative artists very seldom. He says the poet only asks to get his head into the heavens. It is the logician who seeks to get the heavens into his head, and it is his head that splits. And to figure all this stuff out, I think that the author has rightly said, don't waste your time. It's unknowable. It's beyond you. What he's failed to see, I think, in the mystery is the enormous amount of care and protection that he falls into, like that child in the womb. He's missed it, and all he sees is a risk, and there certainly are risks. We were reminded of this with my daughter Lila and her birth, and Patty was on bed rest towards the very end, and you realize just how precarious this can be, just how much we find ourselves in God's hands. Solomon gives us his conclusion there. In the 7 and 8, he realized that the light is pleasant. It's good for the eyes to see. And so in verse 8, he says, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything that is to come will be futility. This is kind of his end result in Proverbs or Ecclesiastes 9:10. He says, whatever your hands find to do, do it with all your might. He's going, whatever you've been given, do it with your full strength that you might maximize your reward on this earth, because that's all you've got. But you hear the quiet desperation sneak in there at the very end. This will be futility. This is the thing. This is what I was reading for you guys in that passage by Ann Voskamp, where you're trying to protect this candle of joy. And so you're guarding it now with everything that you have, just trying to keep it from going out. And you don't realize you're smothering the flame of it. That what this candle needs to burn is it needs oxygen. Excuse me. I need to blow my nose. That means we have to use the first sermon one. You're smothering the flame. Smothering the joy, when instead what it needs again is to be fed. I think that we do this as Christians when we take that joy that we've been given and find ourselves falling back into the world's game of comparison, insecurity, fear, all of these things, jealousy and envy that creep in and affect us oftentimes as much as it affects everybody else. And so the joy we've been given starts flickering and going out. And so we clutch tighter when God is saying, open it up, that it's not at risk of blowing out. Let that thing breathe. I love Psalm 73. That's become really helpful for me in understanding where the author has gone wrong. Because here we have a Psalm of Asaph where he's complaining about the same thing. He's looking at the world and he's going, you know what? The wicked are getting away with it. And the innocent people are suffering. And where is God? But in the middle or towards the end, he says in 16, when I pondered to understand this, it was troublesome in my sight until I came into the sanctuary of God. And there's this wonderful shift that happens here. He gleans all of a sudden in looking into the eyes of God. He sees and hears that quiet wisdom, this wisdom that comes from outside in, this wisdom of revelation. As he comes into the sanctuary, as his eyes are placed on God, as that fear of the Lord begins to take root, he sees God, and not only God, but the heart of God and the goodness of God. So in verse 21, he says, when my heart was embittered and I was pierced within, then I was senseless and ignorant. I was like a beast before you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You have taken hold of my right hand. With your counsel, you will guide me and afterward receive me to glory. And he realizes in looking into God's heart that God is with him, that God is near. He realizes that death is not his end, that his life endures beyond. And that there's this hand reaching down to him, and I love this. The right hand of God reaching down. And you see Asaph in this, reaching his hand up and taking the hand of his father. The end of it in 28, he says, but as for me, the nearness of God is my good. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all your works. And so life, when seen through the nearness and the goodness of God, is a reminder that in the midst of all of this, he's working and that there's purpose and there's growth. But to what end? And it's this realization that life and meaning is enjoyed as we step into our role as stewards of what has been given to us. That all of these things that Solomon is so desperately trying to hold on to and consume were not his to begin with, but have been entrusted to him in order that he might pour these things out on the world. And by the way, I'm not talking just about money, but everything. And in the end, the greatest thing, his heart, that he has to give. Because God is saying, look, life is not about possession. Life is about stewardship. There's a wonderful parable in Matthew 25, but sobering as well, the parable of the talents. And Jesus says, it is like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability. And he went on his journey. Immediately the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and gained 5 more talents. The same manner, the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 talent went away and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. Now, after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 to me. See, I have gained 5 more. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And also the one who had received the 2 talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted 2 talents to me. See, I have gained 2 more. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one also who had received the 1 talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said, you wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to at least put my money in the bank. And on my arrival, I would have received my money back with interest. I think about this story. And isn't it interesting? The one who fails to invest his life is the one who misunderstands the heart of the master. And I think that this happens through our own fault. It's not that God's heart is not seen. It's that it's shown quietly. In Ecclesiastes, at the end of chapter 9, it talks about how folly and foolishness shout, but quietness comes in as a soft voice. And you see this over and over again, that in the hustle and bustle of life, the more we are striving after ourselves and caught up in our own needs, the less inclined we are to hear the voice of the shepherd. And so when we don't understand his heart and we look at the risks of life, we feel precarious. We feel vulnerable. But when we do listen, when we do hear, well, then we understand. It's a really simple thing when it comes down to it. This is a premise that you can easily test. If this is true, then it ought to be that the more that you give and invest your life and your resources and your time in others, the more joy you should feel. If you go out and do that and that proves wrong, let me know. Because it's a guarantee. I don't know anything that is more truthful and easier to test than to invest your life in others and to see the joy in your heart grow. It just does. The problem is that the ego gets in there and wants a piece of the action. And so the only way this happens is a continual laying down of ourself and surrendering and allowing ourselves to function in the joy of what we've been given. Solomon is protecting, he's tightening, he's trying to hold on to his possessions. And so he's strategically moving these things around. And there's wisdom in that. As long as we understand those things are not ours, and that the gains that we make for those are gains to reinvest into the kingdom. Making money in this world can be a great spiritual gift. Many of you are very good at it. And God has called you to take that and invest it in this world. Many of you are sitting out there and you're thinking, I have nothing to give. And God is saying, you have everything to give because you have your heart and you have your time and you have your energy and your love that can be poured out. All God really needs is a willing heart, and then he pours himself through you, which means you've got everything to give. Some of the wisdom of this is knowing the proper time to act, and we saw a little bit of that at the end of chapter 10, feasting in the right season. But how do we know when it's the right time to act? A big part of that is, are we listening and hearing God's voice? And the only way that we do is when we slow down. If the radio's going in the background, it comes really hard to hear that small voice. When we're busy, my kids will say, Dad, 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 Jeff. Like, oh, where was I? Right? And I think sometimes God is like that with us. Jeff, Jeff. Oftentimes when I finally hear his voice, I realize, oh, you've been saying that for a while. I think that we get a plurality of counsel when we hear God's voice. We ask others, does this sound right? It's always good to ask your spouse and then be willing to listen. Patty, I think God wants us to buy an Xbox. Nope. And examining our motives and testing our hearts. Because we have hearts that strive for our own recognition, our own value. God, we even do this spiritually. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him. And as we act, as we invest, is this acknowledging God? Sometimes it's acknowledging God and us. Well, what do? Well, you're very, very careful and cautious about that. I think God has his own little way of ensuring that he'll get the glory, in that he'll often ask us to invest not just the things that we're good at, but that some of our talents are the things that we would consider our weaknesses. I love this by Madeleine L'Engle. She said, in a very real sense, not one of us is qualified, but it seems that God continually chooses the most unqualified to do his work, to bear his glory. If we are qualified, we tend to think that we have done the job ourselves. If we are forced to accept our evident lack of qualification, then there's no danger that we will confuse God's work with our own or God's glory with our own. In other words, if you want to know if God is at work, you're going to have to take steps of faith. And oftentimes those steps of faith are moving into an area where you're particularly weak, like getting out of a boat and walking on water. You go, I'm not very good at that. And God goes, when you do, make no mistake, it will be me that's sustaining you and not yourself. 1 Corinthians 1:27 says, but God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. I think we see that in the middle of chapter 9 of Ecclesiastes, and Mark focused on this guy and his message, this poor wise man that saved the city. You remember this from last week? It's interesting in the passage, we don't even know what this guy did to save the city. Almost as if what bugs the author is the fact that he did it for no recognition. So what was the point? I think this is one of those like red flags that should go off. An area where the preacher, where Solomon missed the point. Because I wonder if that poor wise man that saved the city was doing exactly what he was supposed to do. And he was doing it in a state of self-forgetfulness, thinking nothing of himself. Jesus talks about this in Matthew 6. He says, but when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And so shifting away from the short-term gratification to the long-term view that Solomon is giving us is not going far enough. We're instead called to an eternal view. And in that, there's only one that we're seeking recognition from, and that's our Father. It's not some warped ego sort of gratification, but a child coming to his dad saying, how did I do? And the dad saying, well done. This is the gratification that we seek. If we're not doing that, well, we're not experiencing the life that God has intended for us. If we are doing that, I think again and again we begin to see his hand, his heart being revealed. In our own life and the world around us, we begin to notice the small things. And this is part of learning to walk this walk of faith, is to see where God is at work. I was watching this interview with Carl Jung, and he was asked, does he believe in God? And he said, you know, when I was a child, I used to believe in God. And he said, but now I know. And I thought it just was such a wonderful statement. He says, now I know. And this idea of God's heart, it's not something that we're convincing ourselves of or mustering up the encouragement. It's like as we see it, as we put this into practice, as we invest our lives, then we see and we know, we taste and see that the Lord is good. Jeremiah tells us that we will see God if we search after him with all our heart. As I have been reflecting on just little things in my life, I realize oftentimes that thing that seems least consequential at the time is the most important. And when those things finally dawn on me in my thick-headedness, I go, oh God, you're so brilliant in how he works. That he's softening our hearts and he's restoring vision and meaning and purpose, giving us joy all at the same time. To see his hand helps us understand his heart. And this is how the peace of Christ reigns in our hearts. This is how we have that peace that passes understanding. That peace, like that little red-haired girl just smiling, going, it's going to be okay. No matter how bad it gets, it's going to be okay. I was thinking I would go a whole sermon without quoting Lewis, but then I changed my mind. He talks about this work that God is doing in us, is creating in us what he calls a new man. This is one of my favorite passages. For whatever reason, it brings me such joy reading it. As he talks about the saints, like this poor, wise man who saves the city, being like this secret society. He says, already the new men, and that's us, are dotted here and there all over the earth. Some, as I have admitted, are still hardly recognizable, but others can be recognized. Every now and then one meets them. Their voices and faces are different from ours, stronger, quieter, happier, more radiant. They begin where most of us leave off. They are, I say, recognizable, but you must know what to look for. They will not be very like the idea of religious people, which you have formed from your general reading. They do not draw attention to themselves. You tend to think that you are being kind to them when they are really being kind to you. They love you more than other men do, but they need you less. They will usually seem to have a lot of time. You will wonder where it comes from. When you have recognized one of them, you will recognize the next one much more easily. And I strongly suspect, but how would I know, that they recognize one another immediately and infallibly, across every barrier, color, sex, class, age, and even of creeds. In that way, to become holy is rather like joining a secret society. To put it at the very lowest, it must be great fun. And the joy, the goodness, the meaning that is being longed for has been missed here. And yet it's so embodied in the coming of Jesus. And how the smallness of Jesus' coming was missed by those with this worldly influence clouding their thinking. We as believers are constantly having to let God change our minds, renew our minds, transform our minds. But in this as we listen, in this as we give, in this as we open our hands, in that posture of surrender, we begin to see, to experience life as it was meant to live, to experience that joy, that flame burning brightly. Let me pray. Lord, I just ask you would do this in our lives, in my life, Lord, in the lives of each one here. Lord, that we would become your people, members of your kingdom, bringing this light and this hope and this peace to this world. I pray this in your name. Amen.